This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of April, and the push is still on for Joe Biden's infrastructure proposal, infrastructure being broadly defined. I want to start this week's show by talking about a component of the proposal that hasn't gotten as much attention as some others, over $200 billion to support affordable housing. Now, part of the plan is a sort of race to the top for housing, where the federal government is going to give out grants to municipalities that reform their zoning laws so that it's easier to build housing. But Biden's only proposing to put about $5 billion behind that. The rest of the money would be spent to upgrade public housing, to do energy upgrades of homes, and to subsidize the rehab and construction of 1 million for rent and 500,000 for sale affordable homes. To talk about that, let's bring in this week's Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Lanhee Chen, Diane and David Steffi Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford on the right. Hello, Lanhee.
Hello, Josh.
And on the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Welcome back, Jamel.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jamel, you wrote this week about the plan. Do you like it?
As far as a federal commitment to trying to increase the stock of affordable housing goes, it's not a perfect plan, right? Like I would probably be a bit more ambitious, but it is probably the most sizable investment in affordable housing the federal government has made in a generation. And so if it were to become law, it would be, I think, a very important step forward. I think it's probably worth saying from the top here that the United States is sort of going through a real housing crunch, especially in its fastest growing municipalities and cities. And the country as a whole has built, you know, much less housing over the past decade than it has in previous decades. Some of this is overhang from the Great Recession. Some of this is the product of restrictive zoning laws in many of these same fast growing cities and municipalities. But whatever the reason, the country just doesn't have enough housing for its population, for population growth, and that's showing up in rising rental prices, rising prices for people who want to buy homes, and I think sort of reduced economic growth throughout the country as people basically cannot move to productive places, or alternatively, they are forced out of productive places because of high housing costs. So, to the extent that this begins to make a dent on that problem, and I think the race to the top program for zoning reform is a very important component of this. To the extent that it can make a dent, I think it's a good thing.
Lanhee, a challenge always with trying to approach this from the national level is that we have different housing problems in different parts of the country. Actually, we had Alec McGillis on the show a few weeks ago talking about this. You have some metro areas that have fast economic growth and burgeoning large corporations, and they have a limited housing supply and high prices and affordability issues. And then you have other places where there are plenty of housing units, and there are issues with economic hollowing out. And so you can't have a one-size-fits-all policy for the whole country. We're also in this very odd position where, because of the pandemic, you've had, unlike in a normal economic crisis, you've had a significant run-up in home prices. And to the extent that there is a permanent shift toward work from home, and a lot of people decide that they want more space in their home because they're spending more time there, you could have a permanent level shift in the demand for housing that could make some of that price increase persistent and worsen affordability problems in a lot of places. So what do you make of this approach at this unusual time for housing in the United States?
Well, you've raised a number of very important points there, Josh. So I think, first of all, we're not only seeing upward pressure on homeownership prices or the price of owning a home, we're also seeing upward pressure on rents as well, which is placing pressure on middle-income, lower-middle-income, and working-class families across the country. So housing is a major problem. And I think the biggest part of the problem is what you've identified, and that is that demand and supply differ significantly based on where one lives, the nature of the area, whether it's sort of we're seeing net migration in versus migration out. I mean, all of those questions drive how much access there is to housing that is considered affordable. In terms of what the president's proposing, the concept of some people have termed this as kind of a race to the top-like structure for incentivizing local authorities essentially to do away with practices that make it harder to bring more housing stock online.
Since we've all used the term now, I should just note for listeners, Race to the Top was an Obama administration program that basically gave grants out to state and local jurisdictions that made education reforms.
Right.
And so the idea would be to do that for housing reforms.
Yeah. So the concept of having essentially a federal carrot to incentivize local actions, for example, eliminating the practice of exclusionary zoning, which, you know, practices that essentially make it harder to build more housing stock in many cases. I think that concept to me makes a lot of sense, to basically say we recognize at the federal level we're not going to be able to control exactly what municipalities do with their zoning laws, but we can certainly create incentives for them to make decisions. And by the way, it's not as though this is something that we're finding as a concept that's only on the political right or the political left. You see these kinds of zoning practices in places like the San Francisco Bay Area, where I live. You know, you see lots of communities that have basically said, we don't want more housing stock, or we don't want a certain kind of housing stock here. And so this is not necessarily a right-left issue. I do think, though, that there is some significant opportunity to incentivize change. And to the extent that this kind of spending at the federal level can do it, I think it's a good idea. I think the big question, Josh, is how efficacious is this going to be at the end of the day? Is this going to be enough money to incentivize localities to engage in reform of their zoning regulations? And is it actually going to meaningfully bring the amount of housing stock up? I think that's an open question.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical of that, because I think it's a fundamentally different situation than you had in education, where there was a shared interest at the federal level and at the state and local level in doing experimentation and reforms. And so you had these very willing partners, whereas places that have exclusionary zoning, they generally have it for a reason, for a political reason, that there's significant opposition to changing, I mean, the character of the neighborhood, which you can use either as a literal term or as a euphemistic term. But the places that have made it hard to build housing, there's a lot of political opposition. And I don't know that a grant of, you know, some number of millions or tens of millions of dollars is very likely to change that. I think we've seen some success at the state level in pushing back on these local policies, but that's more with sticks than with carrots, where basically you have laws in places like California and Massachusetts and a court decision in New Jersey that basically say if you don't allow enough affordable housing development in your town or your city, we're going to come in and override your local zoning. And so you have this enormous housing development going up in Cupertino, California, right near the Apple headquarters, over the like wailing objections of local neighbors because of this California law that's been effective in producing that housing. But I think the federal government, I'm not sure how good a position it's in to do those sorts of sticks. I mean, Jamel, this is sort of related to what people might remember from the 2020 campaign as, you know, the Donald Trump's claim that the Democrats were trying to ruin the suburbs, specifically that Cory Booker was trying to ruin the suburbs, although Cory Booker had no real substantial involvement with this. But it was an Obama administration initiative that more or less tied certain federal grant monies to achieving certain goals on affordable housing. So that was, you know, that was a stick approach, which I think could be more effective. But that became a subject of major national controversy in that campaign, with Republicans effectively taking the more regulatory position, sticking up for local regulations of the real estate business, which is what zoning really is.
Lonnie said earlier that this is one of those issues that doesn't really cut clearly across partisan lines, that the problems exist in big liberal cities, small liberal cities. They exist in conservative places. It doesn't really fall across any particular partisan dimension, but there are certainly ways in which it can be demagogued in a partisan way. I think that's what we saw last year with President Trump's campaign. And I would, looking at the internal politics of, big liberal cities or whatnot, what you often see is an attempt to cast these, drives to produce more housing, to loosen zoning regulations. You see that cast in this very, advocates for these things are sticking up for developers. They're for gentrification, attacking these changes from the left. And I'm not, I have no particular, I have no particular read on how one overcomes these sorts of things, other than to say that if we're thinking about federal interventions, to your point, Josh, maybe it would make more sense for the federal government to direct its attention to states and incentivizing states to take action, to essentially act to preempt local and, you know, municipal zoning regulations. I know in Virginia, where I live, there is occasional talk amongst members of the state legislature about loosening up the rules on what localities and municipalities can even do in terms of changing zoning laws, in terms of making the kind of changes that would incentivize the production of more housing, because there are tight limits on sort of the actions local governments can take here. But there hasn't been much discussion, I don't think, about what can the state do to basically incentivize or punish localities and cities in terms of producing their fair share of affordable housing.
Yeah, Lonnie, that's been a really central political debate in California over the last several years, with some of these proposals getting enacted and others being controversial and getting defeated in the state legislature. But it has, as I think you noted, it's created these cross-partisan coalitions on both sides. And I've been particularly struck where, you know, a lot of Republicans do not view this as a straight up business regulation issue, although I think people really ought to think more about real estate and housing as just another business. And if we're going to have regulations on it, we should be aware, like with anything else, of the unintended consequences they may create.
Yeah, it's interesting. In California, what I kind of wonder is to what extent we're going to start to see more effort to put some of these issues on the ballot with such an active public initiative process we have in California, where, you know, we're voting on everything from like free range chickens to, you know, fill in the blank. It would shock me if we didn't see a greater effort by those who are advocates of trying to eliminate some of these local exclusionary zoning practices, if we didn't see more of an effort to elevate that to state initiatives that are brought to the voters directly. Now, that's going to be a very expensive fight, and you're going to have a lot of vested interests involved on both sides of that. But surely it's one of those issues where if action is not forthcoming in the state legislature in California, there would be sufficient public interest that you could see something like that coming forward in the initiative process, if not in 2022, certainly shortly thereafter.
Only $5 billion of this $200 billion proposal is this race for the top trying to change regulation stuff. Most of it is sort of more traditional housing subsidy stuff. Now, I want to break off part of it. There's a lot of money for rehabbing public housing projects and for doing energy upgrades, and I think there are good arguments for that, but those aren't programs to expand the supply of housing. They're programs to improve the housing. Then you have these programs that would further subsidize the construction and in some cases the upgrade of affordable units, of rental and for sale units. And Jamel, I'm wondering, is this something that merits a large additional financial commitment? Because the problem is that if you subsidize housing, but you don't actually cause the creation of more net housing units, then you just end up, you still have a shortage, and you may have reallocated the housing, you may have changed exactly who's affected by the shortage and improved fortunes for some people with low incomes who had affordability issues. But ultimately, if the core problem is that there aren't enough homes in the places where homes are demanded, there's going to be somebody lacking access to the home that they're looking for.
Right, that's certainly true. I mean, I tend to be of the view that solving the housing crisis in the United States is going to be a question of incremental and modest steps forward. And so, although a big investment in constructing new affordable rentals and affordable homes for purchase isn't going to be nearly enough housing construction to, I think, make a major dent in the affordability problem. And this is, you know, beyond the issue which you mentioned earlier, which is that not every area facing a housing crisis, it's facing a crisis of housing affordability. There has to be policies and programs to encourage economic growth in places where there is a large and existing housing stock, but affordable housing stock at that. But as far as a big investment in constructing new housing, I think it's the sort of thing. I think it's the kind of thing where we can begin to create basically virtuous cycles, right? Like if we can begin to get the country and its major metro areas back into the pattern of constructing a large amount of housing, that may help push things forward. But I do wonder if part of the political problem in terms of opposition to constructing new housing in the places where it's needed is simply that many of these places are out of the habit of doing it. That it's just been so long since there have been major pushes for new construction, public or private, that people are just like unaccustomed to what that looks like and are defaulting to kind of a status quo bias. And if the federal government can help jumpstart the process, that itself might be the most important change.
I think I'm a little more pessimistic than you on that. I mean, I live in Manhattan, and it's not hard to find cranes in Manhattan, even though the overall rate of housing production in New York City is actually not very impressive. And even in Manhattan, even in Soho, which the city's fighting over, should we have more housing and more, you know, more tall buildings here? You get people saying that this is, you know, this is overdeveloping the neighborhood, and these buildings are too tall and they're out of character in Manhattan. And so people will even say that in like literally the most appropriate place in the world for new dense high-rise construction. I'm wary of the idea that it's just a matter of getting people used to things. Let's take a break. I'll be back with Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution and Jamelle Bouie of the New York Times to talk about Ron DeSantis and other governors whose COVID records are under scrutiny right now. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution, and on the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at the New York Times. Publix is a regional supermarket chain with over 800 stores in Florida, and the chain became the state's exclusive partner for one aspect of its coronavirus vaccine distribution. Publix had also contributed $100,000 to Governor Ron DeSantis' PAC, and a 60 Minutes report about the state's vaccine rollout heavily criticized the governor for this, suggesting it was pay-to-play. Now, Governor DeSantis had an explanation about why partner with Publix that got cut from the 60 Minutes report. In the case of Palm Beach County, which the report was discussing, over 90% of seniors live within a mile and a half of a Publix. And local officials, including the county's Democratic mayor, have stuck up for Governor DeSantis following the report. Overall, Florida's vaccine rollout is proceeding at close to an average pace. According to the Bloomberg Vaccine Tracker, Florida has given 11 million doses, which is enough to cover 26.6% of its population. The national figure is 27.1%. Florida's performance in terms of deaths in the pandemic has also been pretty average, despite fairly loose rules about activity. 158 out of every 100,000 people in Florida has died of COVID, which is just above California's 152 and below the national average of 170. Nationally, I think there's been something of a disconnect between the perception of how well a state has handled this crisis and the actual numbers about how many people got sick and died and how many people have been vaccinated. Some of the most criticized states like Florida are near the middle of the pack. Some states that did especially well, like Washington State, have gotten very little attention. And of course, there's been a reevaluation of Andrew Cuomo's performance in New York, which is now once again one of the nation's leading COVID hotspots. Lanhee, I look at this with a certain amount of confusion. I don't really get why Florida didn't do worse on COVID cases. I thought at the time that they were happening that some of Governor DeSantis's choices about reopening bars and restaurants, that sort of thing, were reckless. And yet, you know, the performance, it's not great, but it's not terrible either. It's not very different from California, which has operated under a lot more restriction. And so I haven't really known what to make of that. But through the last year, my convictions have actually gotten weaker over time about the right way to respond to this pandemic, because all around the country, state performances have not lined up with what I expected.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment that basically you would have expected if these sort of practices relating to, for example, shutting down businesses or you know, people's ability to go out freely, that would have had a greater impact on whether it's sort of a number of cases or mortality rates. I mean, part of the problem, Josh, is that there's so many different ways to talk about COVID response. And so I think part of this is the problem of lots of states or any governor who wants to tell a good story is going to be able to go and slice and dice the numbers in a way, generally speaking, that makes them look at least reasonably competent. I do think, though, it points to the fact that a lot of the reaction to the public health as well as the regulatory reaction to this virus has been just that. It's been reactive. It hasn't been one of these things that we have sort of studied and had long-standing conclusions about the best way to handle. You know, there are notorious stories about how the six-foot regulation, the concept of keeping 6 feet of social distance, how that came about is essentially, you know, a happy medium between 3 and 10. And, you know, nobody really knew what the right number was, so they settled on 6 because, well, it sounded about right. I think a lot of the reaction to this, the tendency has been in some jurisdictions to make it sound a lot more science-based than really it's actually been. And I think that part of it is disturbing. And that may explain part of why, at the end of the day, you know, you're seeing a lot of evening out of outcomes regardless of kind of the kinds of mitigation efforts that were put into effect. There's also this problem of different states having just different kinds of populations. So in Florida, perhaps it's the case that even though there was an opening up, folks who were older, who were at greater risk, weren't going out. Even though the regulations allowed for them to, they weren't going out, they weren't dining out. And the people who were dining out, generally speaking, were younger and better able to tolerate the virus. So that could be part of it as well. But at the end of the day, I think we are going to look back on this period of time and discover that a lot of what was said by public health professionals as being sort of the law of the land, this is what we have to do, I think we're going to look back on it and realize that maybe there wasn't as much thought or as much analysis put into that as we may have thought there was at the time. And in fact, that might explain why the outcomes are the way they are.
Jamel, what do you make of this? I mean, over the last year, as I say, there were a lot of things that, or a number of things that Florida did that I really thought it ought not to have done at the time. But then there was also a lot of this stuff that the guy in the Grim Reaper costume going out on the beach, shaming people for being on the beach. I think going to the beach is one of the safer activities that you can do during a pandemic of this nature. And sort of it seemed to me like the assumption has been that everything that Florida's doing has to be wrong, and yet they end up performing about averagely. And it feels to me like that's a reason to reevaluate how we thought about a lot of this.
No, I agree. Just thinking to why last year there was this sense that Florida was doing everything wrong, and not just Florida, but Georgia, which I think has been similarly average in its COVID performance. I think it's hard to separate all of this just from the fact that the president had made so much of the COVID response a culture war. I think it was April when President Trump, last April, when President Trump tweeted, liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia, et cetera, about sort of ending COVID restrictions. There was real pressure from the president on Republican governors to sort of follow his lead and ending restrictions. And then this all gets filtered through kind of the culture war mechanics, right? Social media, cable news, all these things. And the fact that Trump reliably polarized the public for him or against him in very predictable ways meant that I think it was difficult for many people to evaluate what various states were doing outside of the context of Trump's own, you know, wishes and desires.
It's funny, though, because I think the extent to which the state-level response to the crisis was partisan has been a little bit overstated in the national media, and it's partly because you have these key examples that you can look at, like Republican governors like Kristi Noem in South Dakota and in some of the southern states who have really taken this defiant position aligning with Trump. But you had other Republican governors like Mike DeWine in Ohio who ran a pretty cautious response that drew a lot of complaints actually from within his own party. One of the best COVID performances was in Vermont, where the Republican governor has had tight restrictions through the pandemic that unlike in California, frankly, do seem to have paid off in terms of low case rates throughout the whole thing. And then you had some Democratic governors like Jared Polis in Colorado, who have had relatively open positioning through this and have allowed more commerce and more activity in their states. And again, it's not clear the extent to which that's been linked to actual performance in terms of how well the state did in the pandemic. Also, over the last few months, as we've gotten into this phase where where it's clear that the restrictions can come off, and the question is just when. You see states like Texas that rapidly lift restrictions, and you get outrage in national media, and then Democratic states like Connecticut do it in a way that isn't that much less of a compressed timeline, and there isn't similar reaction to it. And so, Lonnie, I think part of it is that we're just, people have a tendency to fill in the blanks. They see a Democratic governor doing something restrictive, and they notice it. They see one doing something permissive, and they don't notice it as much.
Yeah, I think we see it through a very politicized lens, and that's certainly the case. I mean, to your point, you've got, Republican governors. You mentioned DeWine. I think Larry Hogan in Maryland, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, two examples of governors that have done reasonably to very well in terms of large elements of their response to COVID. That has gone relatively more under the radar, I would say. And you've got, as you note, the example of Democratic governors that have taken a path that you might expect more from a Republican governor. But at the end of the day, it gets back to the problem we have in terms of defining what we mean by effectiveness of COVID response. It has been such a contagious virus. It has at various points been out of control in pretty much every part of this country that it's hard to sort of look at it state by state and say, okay, are there states that have performed sort of in a truly outstanding fashion one way or the other? And so you end up with a lot of gray area for people to interpret. And I do think that ends up lending itself very well to having a more political conversation as opposed to one that's sort of based on the numbers and the facts, as it were.
I do want to talk a little bit about Andrew Cuomo, though, because Cuomo became something of a national celebrity last April and last March as he was leading New York as it was the total epicenter of this crisis. And I know, personally, people that I know, they really appreciated the governor's presence during that process. They found him personally reassuring. They were getting value out of those press conferences that people around the country were seeing on CNN. And the sentiment that was favorable toward him was very real. And even now, after he's mired both in scandals around COVID and around his personal behavior, his poll numbers, they've fallen, but they haven't fallen as much as you might expect from reading the national media. But I think if you just look at the numbers for Cuomo, you can't say he's had a good performance. I mean, it started at the beginning, where if he'd acted a week earlier to shut down things in the state, which, we didn't have a school closure until something like March 22 last year, I think you could have saved a great deal of lives. And I think that's part of why in the early part of the pandemic, Seattle and the Bay Area, which also had early cases, they acted earlier to shut down. And that led to significantly lower death rates there through last spring. And then we are again in this position of having some of the highest case rates in the whole country. And that is again on his watch. And so what do you make of the liberal love of Andrew Cuomo that rose nationally? And obviously it's certainly diminished in the media, but there still seems to be a lot of affection for him among base voters in New York State.
My sense of this is it's sort of misplaced resistance energy. That at the start of the pandemic, Cuomo, by virtue of showing up on camera and appearing to be in command, engendered a lot of goodwill, and people have just refused to reevaluate that for kind of predictable partisan affective reasons. But it is abundantly clear to me, at least, that there's nothing really in Cuomo's record that, as far as the pandemic goes, that deserves the kind of praise he's gotten from Democratic partisans on those points. But as far as why there's this liberal affection, I chalk it up to the basically distorting effect that Trump had on national politics, that by virtue of polarizing literally everything he touched, it ends up leading on one end people to dismiss approaches, policies that might actually work, that might actually be effective, and on the other hand, perhaps embrace figures that really shouldn't, who really shouldn't be embraced for their performance, for the work they're doing.
Lonnie, I know this has been a real sore point for a lot of Republicans throughout this crisis is the portrayals, particularly of these governor figures in the national media. You have the DeSantis thing with 60 Minutes just in the last few days. You have a year of sort of Cuomo hagiography that has gotten dented now. And I the one pushback I have on that is, you know, what I see locally in New York, the local media, it's not Cuomo being interviewed by his own brother on television. The local media is more critical, and yet there had been up until recently a lot of local goodwill. It's not just a national resistance image. But I do think it's the case that you have seen sort of in national press, particularly on national cable news, you have seen this hagiography, especially of Cuomo and some other Democratic officials, and I think reflexively very negative coverage of some of the Republican officials. And I'm just wondering how much that matters.
Well, it matters a lot in terms of forming, you know, the national narrative about what's going on, and it speaks to, you know, the challenges we have with the news industry in the U.S. right now, and how I don't know if bifurcated is the right word, but really, you know, people want to get their news, and they're left of center, they go one place, and they're right of center, they go another place, and you know, I think that ends up creating a dynamic where, because I think frankly, there's sort of more outlets where one can get a left of center perspective that produces the kind of narrative you see about Cuomo having been very favorable and DeSantis as the contrast being very negative. I think, you know, with respect to Cuomo, it is still shocking to me that more people around the country do not realize just the blatant kind of cover up that went on around what was going on in assisted living and facilities and nursing homes in New York during the early part of the COVID pandemic, and the degree to which those numbers would have made Cuomo's performance look worse at a formative point in the narrative for Cuomo himself. So I think that piece of it's amazing to me that specific part of it hasn't gotten more coverage. In some circles it has. Certainly I don't want to, you know, overstate the point. But the last thing I'll circle back to is the value of local media. And I think that unfortunately we have underinvested in this country in solid journalism and reporting at the local level. And you find that a lot of, frankly, the best journalism that's being done, that's where it's happening. And so I really wish that we would pay more attention to our local newspapers and our local news outlets, because I think a lot of times those are the folks who invest the time in looking at this day to day and really reporting on it in a way that reflects kind of a whole arc of coverage over time, rather than these national drop-ins that allow us to form these completely, in my mind, mistaken narratives about people like Ron DeSantis and, on the other hand, Andrew Cuomo.
Do you think DeSantis is going to be the Republican nominee for president in 2024?
God, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, 64 people are going to run for president on the Republican side. So I don't know if it's going to be Ron DeSantis. But look, I mean, all the Republican donors and folks in the Republican National Committee are gathering in Florida again, you know, as we speak. And so I do think that there's a certain amount of energy around a potential DeSantis candidacy.
It's been interesting to me watching this blow up over the 60 Minutes report, because you have this, for example, this Democratic mayor in Palm Beach County defending DeSantis, and I think that partly that reflects that the 60 Minutes report was not really a fair portrayal of the Florida rollout, but I think it also reflects that DeSantis has done enough development of his own political links in the state that he has Democrats who are willing to go out in national media and stick up for him when they agree with him. I think it's more broadly, I think he has shown a number of aspects of his governance where he has succeeded in simultaneously appealing to the Trump base and doing things that reach out well to moderate voters, push his approval numbers above water. And so I think he is more formidable than Democrats are giving him credit for. If you paint him as this sort of MAGA caricature, you're going to underestimate him, and I think actually maybe not run the right kind of campaign against him if he ends up being the Democratic nominee. I've been talking with Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution and Jamel Bowie of the New York Times. We will be back to talk about the outrage over Georgia's new voting law. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Major League Baseball has announced it will move this summer's All-Star Game from Atlanta to Denver in response to a new voting law enacted by Georgia's Republican-controlled legislature. The proposal, now a law, was born out of Republican complaints that the 2020 election had been misadministered, with many lawmakers believing, for no good reason, that the state was stolen from Donald Trump for Joe Biden. The reforms reflect suspicion of voting methods primarily used by Democrats, such as drop boxes for mail-in voting, which will be reduced in number in heavily Democratic counties. But the bill took on a significantly different form as enacted than some of the initial Republican proposals. It actually expands early voting on certain dimensions, for example. And while the state's Republican Party was at each other's throats over the 2020 election results, Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger robustly defended last year's result, causing intense attacks from the president and his supporters. Raffensperger and his allies mostly agree with the Trumpier Republicans that these reforms are net positives for the state's voting system. Now, Democrats point to provisions that disfavor their voters' favored voting methods, plus a provision that could subject local election boards to more political control in a future effort where you might have someone trying to overturn an election result. They also note the motivation behind the law, the fundamental implication that high Democratic turnout was invalid in a state where African Americans are the core of the Democratic Party base. The law has led to corporate outrage, including the MLB move, and to conservative counter-outrage, with Mitch McConnell, of all people, telling corporations to stay out of politics. Jamel, Joe Biden has called this law Jim Crow in the 21st century. Is that a fair characterization of this law?
No, I think that's an exaggeration. I wrote a column about sort of the Jim Crow analogy, and I think my essential point in that column is that although I think you can draw similarities to Jim Crow voting laws, which kind of, I think, pace popular belief didn't say, you know, black people can't vote, but they were really sort of a web of restrictions, some subtle, some not, that ended up essentially removing black Americans and also many white Americans from the voting electorate. But for as much as you can kind of draw some comparisons and make some analogies, I think the simple fact is that, and this will sound somewhat tautological, but that now is not then, right? That the motivations are not identical. The social circumstances are completely different, and it is just like for whatever links there may be to the past here. And I do think that the context of not just the previous election, but sort of Georgia's status as a Jim Crow state until relatively recently, I think those things should be brought to bear here. But the differences, I think, are too important to simply say this is just like Jim Crow, and certainly too important to say this is, you know, Jim Crow on steroids, or this is somehow worse than Jim Crow voting laws. I don't think that's true, even as I think that there is value in parsing comparisons and making analogies.
But I mean, to be clear, you think Democrats have good reason to be strenuously objecting to this bill, right?
I do. My reasons for why it's worth objecting to this bill are, first of all, I think that the motivation does matter. Even if it isn't as egregious as what was originally proposed, a bill whose roots are in basically a nonsense narrative that there was somehow fraud or illegal voting in Georgia, and that there were serious voting problems that had to be dealt with, I think is simply not true. Pretty much every measure, the election nationally and in Georgia specifically was remarkably well run given the circumstances. And, you know, there's no real evidence of the kinds of problems that are the stated motivation for this law. The problems that do exist that we saw in Georgia, long lines, unequal distribution of voting resources, those are the kinds of things that really aren't affected by this law and may even end up, some provisions may even end up making it worse for people in the most populous counties in the state. I think the provisions that essentially create more partisan control over election administration are very troubling, again, given the context, right? The context here isn't some abstract, you know, ideas about accountability. It is both the former President Trump's very open call for election officials in Georgia to do something to help him win the state after the fact. And as well, the proliferation of a, I think, very dubious constitutional theory that state legislatures have basically plenary power over every single aspect of election administration and elections in their states and can do whatever they want with regards to them. Those things together very much inspired some of these provisions, again, handing partisan control over elections to the state legislature. And I find those very troubling. And I think it's worth opposing the law on that basis. I think I would also add that one of the giveaways is just that this law was written very quickly with very little Democratic input. So it doesn't even look like the process wasn't even the kind of thing that would inspire good faith here.
Yeah, Lanhee, the Republican response to the outrage over this has been basically that people are distorting what's in the bill. In some cases, they're making false claims about what's in the bill. Sometimes that's because there was a proposal that could have been in the law, but it didn't make it into the final form. That Georgia's voting rules after this look similar to some states that are run by Democrats, where people don't find those laws to be overly restrictive. And I think as a substantive description of the law, that's largely true, with the exception of these partisan control provisions, whose effect I think is going to be unknown. And you know, I mean, the Georgia Secretary of State is a partisan position, and his power is being stripped. But you know, it just so happened that the Georgia Secretary of State took a stance against Trump's efforts here. You could have had a Republican who was more partisan. So I don't think the old system was free of partisan control issues either. But I mean, all that said, I think the context here, as Jamil notes, really is important, which is that, you know, if the Republican Party, a majority of it, lines up behind a former president's effort to throw out an election result because he doesn't like it, and just makes up claims about how the election was run in the wrong way that, you know, fundamentally amount to that too many Democrats and too many black people voted, that whatever Republicans then do driven by that will be viewed with deep and appropriate suspicion. And so basically, I think to a significant extent, the Republican Party made its own bed here.
Well, look, context matters. I understand that. But it doesn't provide license to misrepresent, distort, or lie about the content of what's in this legislation. And look, I'm not 100% for all the provisions that are in here, but I think a number of the more, you know, let's call them controversial ones, have been distorted. And the context for those pieces of the legislation hasn't been accurately given. So, you know, I think context does matter, and so I understand that point of view. I'll say the other thing that matters also is that you do have in some states, quite frankly, efforts to roll back access to the vote that I find abhorrent. And so when you're doing that in other places, I understand why it creates an overhang. But all that having been said, I think with the Georgia example particularly, the egregious misstatements, the way in which this has been mischaracterized by people all the way up to the president of the United States and has resulted in the kind of backlash that we've seen, I think people are understandably upset about that, too. So, you know, again, it speaks to how polarized we are. But if we could only have like a fair discussion about the specific elements of this law, and by the way, the specific elements of proposals in other states that, you know, will or won't restrict people's access to the vote, I think that is the best way to proceed. Because frankly, after an election, there are things you want to look at in an electoral system. Are there ways we can improve this? You know, for example, in Georgia, one of the things you can do now with this new law is you can count absentee ballots sooner than would have been permissible under law previously. And that's a lesson that states learn, that the best way to process these things quickly is to, you know, to allow these votes to be counted as they're received. And so that's something that ultimately, at the end of the day, improves the system in the long run. Very difficult, though, to have a conversation about these more technical elements when we get hung up on things that are more controversial and frankly, contextual.
Jamil, Nate Cohn, who covers polling and elections for the New York Times, had a controversial piece in the last few days about the Georgia election law, basically saying that a lot of this stuff matters very little in terms of electoral outcomes. That when you change rules about when absentee ballots need to return or to be returned or how many days of early voting that there are going to be, that the effects on turnout and the effects on electoral outcomes actually end up being really small. That those convenience matters don't affect who votes as much as people think. And partly that's because mail-in voting, because you have to plan in advance to vote by mail, he suggests that it appeals largely to voters who had a high turnout propensity anyway. And so if you are, you know, not deciding until a couple of days before the election whether you're going to vote or how you're going to vote, the mail-in voting rules probably don't matter very much for you in terms of whether you're going to turn out. And I think I'm broadly persuaded by the case that he makes here, and that doesn't mean that people shouldn't care about the rules around voting, but my concern for Democrats is that there are other things that really do affect electoral outcomes a lot. Now, one is this political control issue that is hard to evaluate in advance. It's a risk that we can only see after the election, whether someone can interfere with the result. But another thing is redistricting, which is one of many, many provisions in this huge voting law package that Democrats call HR1. They've been pushing at the national level. Rules about how you draw congressional districts that affect, whether you have a map that tilts toward one party or the other, that really affects outcomes a lot. And I would really like to see Democrats focusing intensely on that at the federal level and not worrying so much about whether you have 10 days or 17 days of early voting, because I think that's the thing that's really going to affect control of Congress. Am I wrong on that?
No, I don't think you're wrong. The point that these sort of changes to voting laws on this level aren't necessarily the real concerns people ought to have, I think, is exactly right. Let me add a sort of a supported point. I think Republicans are underestimating the extent, insofar that there are Republicans trying to restrict the number of people who are coming out to vote, I think they are themselves underestimating the extent to which this could harm them if their political coalition has basically swapped high propensity voters for low propensity voters. Having said that, I agree. Things like gerrymandering or extreme partisan gerrymandering are far more detrimental to people's ability to engage in their democracy than changes to voting rules. To use one state, for example, Wisconsin has a state legislative gerrymander that is so biased towards Republicans that there is essentially no way for the voting public to kind of a voting majority in Wisconsin to directly dislodge the Republican Party in the state legislature. For my part, trying to undo those gerrymanders, trying to bring kind of competitive districts to as many places in the country as possible is the right move. It should be possible for a majority of the voting population to remove a party to disagree with, although geographic-based districts mean that there's never going to be exact one-to-one correlation between vote share and seat share, it should not be the case that a party that consistently is winning 45, 44, 46% of the two-party vote is winning 55, 56, 57% of the seats. That to me is just unacceptable. And the Constitution has this provision that every state's guaranteed a Republican form of government. That's the kind of thing that would make me question whether the state actually has a Republican form of government, lowercase r.
Lonnie, is there a justification for political control of district drawing? I know it's a long-standing practice, and the legislatures and the courts have allowed it, but what's the reason that we should have lawmakers draw their own districts?
I don't know that we should. I think part of the effort that we've seen in states is to try to remove the process from the political forum. I mean, certainly in California, that was the idea when we went to this concept of a citizens redistricting commission. Now, the problem, of course, is when you have citizens that are apparently nonpartisan who actually have a very strong ideological point of view. And that's hard. It's very, very hard to draw people into a process like this who truly are independent and who truly view the redistricting process through the lens of, trying to create fair competition, but who also have sufficient, frankly, subject matter expertise to be participating in that process. So there's a tough problem here, which is that the political process has so – I shouldn't say the political process, I should say politics – has become so infused into so many different aspects of our lives that it becomes difficult to remove this process entirely from the political forum. That having been said, the concept of lawmakers themselves directly, whether it's horse trading or, you know, protecting their own interests, which they, of course, are certain to do. The direct involvement of lawmakers in the process of drawing lines, that to me feels at this stage of our politics to be the wrong approach.
We've reached that time again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jamel Bowie, what's your rant?
My rant relates to our first topic here, housing. We should have talked about how this isn't necessarily a partisan or ideological problem, but I think you can fairly say that it is within liberal communities where there are the toughest battles to expand housing supply, and often amongst sort of affluent liberals who would consider themselves staunch progressives, but who, when it comes to building any kind of housing in their neighborhoods, to say nothing of affordable housing or housing for seniors or housing for the homeless, become, you know, staunch reactionaries. And so my rant is basically against those liberals that either, you know, live up to your stated ideals, your stated progressive beliefs, or at least stop lying to yourselves about where your politics lie, that it is hypocritical to, on one hand, say, rail against former President Trump for wanting to build a wall, and then in your own neighborhood, effectively building that wall against people who have lower incomes or who want to live in multifamily housing.
Lonnie Chen, what's on your mind?
U.S. Senator Joe Manchin may be the most important man in Washington, and that's a good thing for those of us who believe that compromise is a valuable thing for the making of good public policy. Manchin's opposition to eliminating the filibuster, as well as to bastardizing the budget reconciliation process, the fast-track authority the Senate has to deal with strictly budget-related matters, in an effort to ram through massive policy changes, ultimately drove President Biden to conclude, quote, "Debate is welcome. Compromise is inevitable. Changes are certain." Biden also added that inaction is unacceptable. He's right. The two parties can and should come together to pass legislation that focuses on real infrastructure priorities, and that's not just limited to roads, bridges, and ports, but it almost certainly doesn't include, as Biden's proposal does, changes that, for example, make it harder for people to opt out of joining labor unions. Here's to hoping that compromise won't continue to be a dirty word, and that both parties can do their jobs and actually get something done together.
For my rant, like many cities around the world, New York has had a major expansion of outdoor dining during the pandemic. The program here is called Open Restaurants, and it has tables spilling out into what were once parking spaces on the street. The program is being made permanent, and it's a great improvement to the streetscape. But it's also an important economic improvement. Extremely valuable land, once used for parking, often free parking, is now more economically productive. As indoor dining reopens, the city's total restaurant capacity will be left larger than it was before the pandemic. That means more restaurant meals, more jobs for waiters, more sales tax, more income tax, more economic activity here in New York. And it's a question for cities around the world to say, are there other instances where there are underused public lands, resources that the government owns for the people that are not being used to their full potential? And what would it mean for our society if we reimagined how our public spaces were being used? That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Jamel Bowie and Lonnie Chen. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and is recorded and mixed by Michael Stark and Kat Yore. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.